This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, the morning. I'm Sharad Kutan with me, Kusu Chuang, Joyce Goh. The week begins. It is the 23rd of October, just past 6 o'clock in the morning. We're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock with an amazing array of voices and opinions and thought-provoking interventions. Now, you both came off this weekend. I hope it was good for you. It wasn't so good for 9 people buried under a landslide at a construction site in Tanjung Bunga in Penang. The both of you, I know, are from Penang, Joyce and Chuang, and so I know you might be particularly concerned. None of the people killed were Penangites. I believe they, from the reports that we have, that 4 Bangladeshi, 3 Myanmar, and 2 Indonesian workers were killed when that landslide happened. Now, the controversy seems to be that the Department of Environment had rejected the application for at the planning stage for the Penang developer of that particular site. And so now, you know, I think the Penang state government is also under some deep scrutiny following this tragedy.
Well, actually, that project is within spitting distance of my father's house in Tanjung Bunga. And you're right, because when I looked, I've also got a very small unit there, and from my balcony, I can see the development that you know, the project area used to be verdant jungle, okay? And now that whole area has been cleared, and there's all condos and houses. You know, the most immediate vicinity of the project is actually owned by Bunsiu, the BSG group. I'm not sure where the landslide happened, but it's back nearer the hillside.
Near the hill area.
Yeah, near the hill area. It's actually very, very near Alila, which is also owned by Hunza Property.
Mm. Okay, we're going to try and follow up with the story later in the morning, see if we can get some expert opinion on what exactly is happening, especially in terms of the Penang State Government's record on these matters, whether it's hillside development or listening to NGOs and community groups that I believe from reports we now know were voicing their concerns about that particular development. Now, also in the news, a former lecturer has been detained by the police on suspicion of humiliating the Prime Minister and his wife by modifying an image, presumably an image of the two, on social media. Also in the news from Japan,
where the
Prime Minister Shinzo Abe secured
won
a
landslide victory.
He did. In fact, a good landslide.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yes, a good landslide. Yes.
Which is actually quite incongruous with the in terms of the economic performance of the country and his Three Arrows campaign. So the
Three Arrows of Abenomics.
Abenomics, yeah.
Yeah, so the Liberal Democratic Party and its smaller coalition partner, Komito, set to pass the 310-seat threshold in the 465-seat House of Representatives, giving them a supermajority and will allow Shinzo Abe to revise the nation's constitution. Apparently, he is concerned in particular with a provision in the constitution that suggests that Penang, you know, will eschew any war. It will eschew any kind of militaristic ambitions and such. And this is something. So it's Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution. It still remains to be seen whether this is accepted in the region, which is very suspicious, of course, of any kind of build-up of Japan's military, now known as the Self-Defense Forces. Now, we'll be back with more news and analysis. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, A Flashlight by Parliament. I'm Sharad Kutan with me, Joyce Goh and Kusu Chuang. It's coming up to 10 minutes past 6. It is the 23rd of October. And we're getting to that time of year when most companies engage in annual reviews.
Yeah, so year-end review season is upon us. Are you ready? And there's this article that we saw recently that just came out in Fast Company. And it's on 11 phrases that can ruin your performance review. And they gave a list of things that, you know, perhaps they're suggesting that you should not say at your review, whether or not that is. But do you think year-end reviews are effective?
Yeah, so even before we get to how to be effective doing year-end review, there is the larger question of whether year-end reviews are effective. I do think personally that it's important for supervisors and managers and bosses and people who work for them to check in on each other in terms of expectations. I think that conversation needs to happen, and it perhaps should happen at least once a year.
Yes, but it could happen throughout the year.
It could, yeah. But then you do need mechanisms, don't you?
Well, you see, I've got a very different view of this whole issue of annual performance reviews. I'm going to say two things, right? The first thing I want to say is, because I've been working for many, many years.
Many years.
More than
you can count on your fingers and toes, actually.
Exactly. You're right, Sharad. Yeah. Mr. Kutin.
I mean, you have a few extra ones,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, unless I'm, one of those things from the future. But, I despair sometimes with the amount of time and effort and stress that's inflicted on employees and managers when it comes to annual performance reviews, because at the end of the day, the larger picture is how much increment are most companies going to give you, right? They're not going to give you, not in this day and age, double-digit increments, right? Mm. They're going to give you something, and they're going to benchmark it to inflation. So if inflation is, say, 4%, you will do well to get 6% income increase on your salary, right? And if you do badly, you'll probably get something at 2 or 3%, if at all, and then you might not get a bonus. When you analyze it against your larger income on an annual basis, it is not very much, right? So what do you have to do? I think that people have to spend more time on investing and putting their money aside and making it grow elsewhere rather than putting so much time into the annual performance reviews. That's the first thing. The second thing is, don't worry about all these comments and statements that you've got to say, because at the end of the day, the only thing that matters to any employee in this world is to do this. Make yourself as indispensable as possible, because if you're fantastic at your job, you will do well.
But,
period.
But nobody's indispensable. I mean, even bosses.
No. So for example, if you're a journalist, right? Mm. If you are fantastic at breaking stories week in, week out, fantastic stories that move the share price of a listed company, right? You will be near as indispensable.
But okay, let's come back to the article from fastcompany.com. It might have been written from an employer's perspective, because one of the phrases you apparently shouldn't utter is, can I have a raise?
Yes, so I was looking at that.
Because if you've really done well, that raise will come notwithstanding. And if your manager don't give you that raise, you vote with your feet and you just say, well, sorry, the Wall Street Journal, the Dow Jones, Reuters,
but
and
how
Bloomberg
many of us realistically, Chuang, are in a position to say, especially during these economic times.
Yeah, these times where jobs are it's tough, in a way, and the whole industry, depending on which industry
you're in.
Well,
Sadhguru says, right? Sadhguru from
India?
No,
I don't.
Why?
You don't. Well,
what did he say?
He's one of those, sagely individuals who walk around in a loincloth, but dispenses wise advice. He says, don't be afraid, because if you're good at what you do, you need not be afraid. And you just make that little step into the wild blue yonder and the future is there for you.
Well, those are inspirational words, but, in some ways it's the kind of stuff of motivational talks, not of the real world. Because, when, the global oil and gas sector shed 200,000 jobs, it wasn't because people weren't good at their jobs that they lost their jobs. It was that the sector just could not support
it. Yes, the operating landscape, it just turned challenging.
Can I tell you guys a story? I used to run a .com, right? Back in the late 90s, early 2000s, right? And we went from 55 people to 6 people in a matter of weeks. Okay,
55 to 6. That's a sharp reduction.
Savage cost cutting. My department was the biggest. I had 20 people under me, right? And it was really, I'm not going to go into details because it's a bit sensitive, right? But
sad. I can see the tears welling up.
Yes, I was very emotional. When it comes time for disaster, when times become challenging, it's either an opportunity or a time to wallow in despair, right? And several people in my team, when they got sacked, they went on to found their own businesses. And in a particular case, there was a design consultancy that they started. And within weeks of setting up, they already had projects on their hands.
Wow, and it's still
because they were
today?
Good.
But you're cherry picking. There will be those who didn't succeed, who floundered as a consequence.
But you have
of
to
that.
Take things into your own hands. Your future is not your boss's whim; it is your whim.
Okay, fascinating. We're going to tweet out a link to that story, and you can, of course, join the conversation by tweeting us at BFM Radio, WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. We'll be back. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Do It Again by Steely Dan. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Joyce Goh and Kusu Chuang. It is coming out 23 minutes past 6. It is the 23rd of October. The numbers align. So,
yes, it is.
Yeah, okay. So the question is, do your accounts, at least in terms of how you earn and how much you earn and how much you spend?
Yeah, so this particular yarn comes from that apogee of journalism, thestar.com.my.
And it's actually mockery so early in the morning.
No,
it?
It's not. I didn't say that. You did, Sharad. But, okay, so this is one of those sections in the weekend paper that I actually quite like reading. It's the personal finance, right? And it deals with a term called lifestyle inflation, written by a girl called Nadia Khan, right? So what is lifestyle inflation? Basically, the more you earn, the more you spend. And we've seen it all over the place, right? Every time you get a salary increment, you get a new car, you get a new flat screen TV, you move into a bigger house, you buy nicer food for your stuff for yourself, you go to better places. But the counter argument to this is if you decide to turn this whole notion on its head and decide that the more you earn, the more you spend, and the more you earn, the more you save and stroke invest, which then becomes very interesting from a long-term perspective, because then at the end of the day, you don't have as many gadgets in your house or whatever, which, by the way, gets obsolete within 1 or 2 years. You've got that much more numbers in your, or zeros in your bank account.
But what about just, you know, compensating yourself for all the hard work? What about
treating yourself?
Why not?
That is the reason why people do that, lah. You know, like, got more money, got more motors. Oh, you know, it's all because I've done really well. I'll just get the 3 Series BMW and then...
Wow, you really jump up. I mean, I don't know if people move so quickly to the 3 Series.
No, hey, because nowadays, I mean, that is the aspiration, right?
Maybe not that, but maybe, or maybe I'll go for a facial or something, one off. I'm not talking about buying a 3 Series.
And then where does it stop?
Well, I mean, there's just so many facials you can do. And
yeah.
Once you have a facial, then you have the manicure, then you got the pedicure, then you color your hair. See, I know all these things. And then you got the SK2.
Oh, we know about the coloring your hair.
SK2.
I know these things.
Okay, but no, I mean, so the question is, where do you go from just being blindly spendthrift, you know, and not watching the bottom line and, you know, in terms of things like savings, investments, and when is it just reasonable, especially as you're just taking off, don't you need to, in fact, you know, reward yourself so that psychologically you feel that this is all worth it?
Yes, and enjoy, like, all the hard work, the fruits of your labor, in a way, right?
Okay. Absolutely. So, okay. You know, so at which point, is it true in every situation that the more you earn, the more you should be saving and investing? Is there a kind of magical number in terms of ratio of how much you spend and how much you save?
I think in everyone's lives, there are several inflection points, right? One is once when you don't make very much money, then you make more money, then you start to say, okay, well, it's time to reward myself. And then there comes a point in time after that when you say, okay, well, there's come time when I've really enjoyed stuff. It's time for me to pare back and really invest for the future. And, you know, everybody goes through this. Is at what point in your life that you do this? And not many people even realize that those inflection points exist. I just want to make one final point, right? There's a thing called the debt loop. The debt loop is something where when you get into this whole issue of paying credit card debt, mortgage debt, high purchase debt, it is very difficult to come out of. And that is why the holy grail is zero debt.
Okay. Words of wisdom there. And soon we'll have Barry Maguire, Eve of Destruction, taking us all the way up to the first bulletin of the morning. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Always the Sun by The Stranglers. Kusu Chuang, Joyce Goh, myself, Sharad Kutin. It's coming up to 40 minutes past 6 on the 23rd of October. Remember, you can join us in this conversation at any point. Just tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Now, following the revelations in Hollywood of sexual harassment or assault by Harvey Weinstein, a hashtag's been going around that's gone viral, Me Too, with a lot of women coming out to describe their experiences of sexual harassment at the workplace and otherwise. And I think it's created a kind of a storm around the world, at least that, you know, sort of engage with kind of that American discourse, including Malaysia, regarding, you know, the place of women and the kinds of experiences they have. And what's come out of this, because is a debate in the last couple of days with a local and fairly well-known tweet personality, YouTube, that's YOUTIUP if you want to look it up. He came out to say that, well, this is true, and, you know, women are harassed, but in a situation where a good friend of his was the perpetrator of the harassment, he wouldn't out the friend, he wouldn't go public with it, but he would privately admonish that friend. And so then the question was, you know, was he demonstrating a kind of bro culture, you know, when men band together and protect each other against, you know, any kind of censorship or censure from larger society? And it's a fascinating discussion because what he's been accused of is sacrificing women to protect men.
So what will happen if he talks to his friend, but the friend doesn't stop? So what will happen after that? I mean, if he says, okay, he's not going to out the friend, but he'll have a chat with his friend, right? So but what if the friend doesn't stop and he continues doing it?
Well, I've worked in organizations that have had exactly that same bro culture you talked about. I'm not going to say which company it was, but basically there were a whole bunch of guys that were traveling around Asia, and then they all, you know, one of them got a job in this place, and then suddenly all five of the other friends joined the company, and within a few years they had become, you know, quite senior people in the organization, and they were kind of like impregnable in terms of the, you know, the things that they did and what they, you know, what happened. And it's prevalent all over the world.
So bro culture is a broader thing, right? Where men kind of support each other. In this case, they're friends who, you know, thick as thieves, and they hire each other. They, you know, they like each other's company, and they get away with a lot of things. The question is, in a situation where what they get away with is clearly against your own moral standards. So you think that what your friend has done is wrong, but at the same time, there's this tug of loyalty. Now, which wins? And I think that's the question that's at stake, and that's the heart of this Twitter storm here in Malaysia, you know, following the Me Too hashtag.
Yes. So, I mean, for me, it's more of like, okay, fine, you want to talk to your friend about it, you don't want to out your friend, but what if the friend doesn't stop? To me, that is the question. Because right here, you can see what's happening in America, the amount of people who have come out to say, hey, it's Me Too. With the same guy, we're talking about the same guy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and the number of names that have come out. Some of these are women who are confident, who are independent, and the names that have come out, you'd be shocked to see all these names, and there are so many of them, right?
I think the other side of the coin is the number of men, well-known men, who were in some ways complicit through their silence. And I think that's the more troubling aspect of it, at least from a male point of view, I think a man's point of view, the complicity of other men in, you know, the wanton exploitation of women in a situation where the power relations allow for it. But, you know, Chuang, do you think there is this tug between personal loyalty and principle in this case?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I went through a personal example of exactly the situation where the company head was accused of harassing a colleague. And I was actually called in to take a side, and actually took the side of my colleague.
But the company head, was he a friend of yours?
I didn't say it was a he. I'm not going to say, you know, because obviously it's still...
Well, but, you know, we're talking about precisely men exploiting women, I think.
But it can be a female majority workplace, and men are prejudiced. You know, these things happen as well. I mean, the issue I'm trying to say is...
There's a clear asymmetry. I mean,
correct,
men
correct,
overwhelmingly
correct. Yeah, it's true.
Do the raping.
It
I mean,
is
you
true.
Know, regardless. I mean, it's just a fact.
That might be the case, but there are other organizations which do have a female majority workplace, and I'm saying it can work both ways, right? So what do you do as an employee? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but this
what
is, should but, you so do? But the question at hand, and this is the controversy, it is not about professional relationships. It's personal relationships. Friendship and the loyalty that you owe a friend versus
do you
what
rat,
you
like,
think
basically,
is,
right?
Do you
so the
and
Weinstein,
what you think is you know
yeah,
is
do you,
wrong?
Do you rat? Yeah, do you out?
Do
the
you
friend?
Rat? Like, I mean, okay, Weinstein is Weinstein. He's America. Okay, I'm talking about Malaysia. Local, everybody has a personal experience. Right? What do? You rat on your friends or your buddies and your bros, or do you take the principled moral high ground and say what you did, mate, was wrong? I think you should stop. And if you don't, then I'm going to disenfranchise you. Well, I mean, what you do, it's your personal call at the end of the day, is what you hold closest and dearest to your heart.
Okay, fascinating stuff. Do join the conversation. Tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. We'll be back. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Me and You by Jake Bugg, BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Kusu Chuang and Joyce Goh. Now, Google has just ushered in a new dawn for artificial intelligence, or AI. Well, so it seems Google's AlphaGo Zero took just 3 days to master the ancient Chinese board game of Go. Now, this is just adds a fuel to the fire, fears that AI is a threat to humanity, and not just our jobs, but in the very realm of our control of our own lives. We spoke to Arnd Heinz, an AI developer at Michigan State University, and one of the things he addressed was the inevitability of AI taking over all our jobs. And then the question is, how would we function as a society?
Autonomous machines that take away human thinking and automate human thinking essentially take away, quotation mark, jobs, right? It's industrial revolution, but not just for muscle labor, but also for intelligence, cognitive labor, which is so far the last human domain, and we're taking this away with AI technology. And that means that we're having an extreme socioeconomic impact. We literally, hopefully at some point, get everybody out of a job. And that sounds like a complete nightmare scenario because, well, if I'm out of a job, how should I make a living? And the answer is we have to change our society in such a way that that's not a problem. Wealth and everything that's produced by those machines have to become redistributed in such a way that's benefiting for everybody. So I'm really afraid that our socioeconomic system basically takes all this autonomy in these machines and just turns on turbo capitalism and then runs everybody out of a job. And then we have one person that owns everything because that one person has all the means of production and all the power. And then everybody is completely helpless. And we have to prevent that. And that's really the danger, that we are not redistributing the wealth that is created by these autonomous machines, I guess.
The other nightmare scenario is that these super intelligent machines will start a world war and, in fact, conquer the world. Arnd has some tips on how human beings can live harmoniously with super intelligent machines.
The answer to how do we deal with these conscious machines is the answer to how do we deal with super intelligence. Because the fear is, oh my God, super intelligence will destroy us because it's so much smarter and so much more powerful and it wants to have a universe without us. I guess that's the idea. Or that's the fear. And I guess the answer is no, if we manage to treat sentient beings equally and peacefully and we have interaction and trade and positive interactions with that type of technology, and if we recognize that this type of diversity is actually something that we want to have and that we have to embrace and foster, well, then that intelligence will recognize this and understand that this is a good thing to do, and then we'll also play along nicely. And on top of that, I mean, my technician made this very nice comment. He said, well, also the universe is pretty big. If we have robots that can, in theory, at least live forever, what's the point in conquering Earth if there's a whole universe out there? So it's not that we are running out of resources at some point, and those artificial beings are probably much more capable of exploring the universe than we are, being biological beings. So I think that the take-home message really is, if you're afraid of super intelligence, well, yes, if you are not a nice person and if you want to dominate that type of technology, well, that's going to backfire. At the same time, if you recognize the synergy and what you can get with this and thrive for a peaceful interaction with that type of technology, then I think there's nothing to fear. But it means that we as a society have to actually change and not fight each other or hate each other, but embrace diversity and embrace differences and tolerate everybody as they are and not start discriminating just because something is black or white or built by a machine or has a battery. That's the same type of discrimination at some point. But again, I mean, this is super sci-fi what we're talking about.
That was Arnd Heinz, an AI developer at Michigan State University, talking about the possible nightmare scenarios coming out of the domination of artificial intelligence or AI in the world economy and in our society.
It is scary that if you think about the number of jobs that potentially robots and AIs could do when they have been developed, and the amount of things that we can't when they can come into the picture and do it. I think Jack Ma has spoken about this before, about how AI and technologies will cause people more pain and happiness over the next a few decades to come, and that's scary. And how he says that will impact social, it will have a social impact on people.
You know, I was talking to a doctor recently. He was saying that at a discussion with one of these developers, presented to doctors and oncologists and all that, the diagnostic tests and the predictions for some of these machines outstrip anything that a human doctor can do. And so this person doing the presentation said that in a kind of with a celebratory note in his voice about, you know, this is the future and how exciting it was, talking to a group of people who knew that the future was bleak for them as professionals because they were getting it at about 60%. The machine was getting it over 90% in terms of predicting, you know, a cancer and such.
You know, people like Elon Musk, Bill Gates, Stephen Hawking, people like that have all basically said that the rise of the robots is probably one of the most dangerous things to humankind in the coming future. Basically, it spells the end of the human race because robots will just basically it's not about losing your job. It's about being displaced by the machines. And, you know, do you know at this point in time, Google technology, in terms of face recognition, in terms of voice recognition, in terms of word-to-text recognition is 95% or better already.
But can they take over the jobs of radio presenters?
Absolutely.
Radio presenters?
Absolutely.
Do you think the spontaneous wit, the repartee, the critical...
Do you know that 4 years ago I was studying a software, right, that basically displaced journalists, right? It could basically write sports stories, general news, current affairs stories within seconds. All it needed was data entry.
Yeah, and this,
so who's going to put the data entry? Who's going to do the data entry?
Great, but at some point in time, the robots can do it because
they know
all
what's
these
a
sensors.
Lead and what's a news
absolutely,
break.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm not so sure. I think the jury's out on that. We'll wait to see. Ozark Mountain Daredevils, if you want to get to heaven, taking us all the way up to 7 o'clock, then the bulletin, and then we'll be back with more news and analysis. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Joyce Goh and Kusu Chuang. And time to look at some of the more provocative stories that we have in the media. Now, the Personal Data Protection Commission is conducting an investigation into a probable breach, data breach by an unknown source. The breach was first reported by laoyat.net, but around 2 hours after the report was uploaded, laoyat.net removed the story on the orders of the Malaysian Communications and Multimedia Commission, or MCMC. Stolen data reportedly included customer names, billing addresses, mobile phone numbers, SIM card numbers, handset models and MyCard numbers of various telco customers. To find out more about the potential implications of the breach, we spoke to Culture Pop's Matt Armitage.
Oh, gosh. I mean, where do you start with implication? If it's true, then, I mean, to be honest, I think we've got to the point now where everyone in the world should just assume that their data has been stolen. We hear about these kind of massive data breaches in pretty much every country around the world. I think we should just assume that if our information is being stored on a database somewhere, it isn't safe. And you should assume that somebody else has at some point managed to gain some of your details, whether that's addresses or phone numbers or social security numbers or passport numbers, identity card numbers. There really isn't any way to keep your data safe in the kind of environment, the online environment we have today.
So we asked Matt if there's anything we can do as individuals to secure our data as much as we can.
Well, there really aren't any steps that we can start taking because it's not being stolen from us. So when you go to a bank, you know, when you go to any organization and you give them personal information about you, you can't assume that they're going to be able to keep that information safe because there is no way to keep that information safe. So the only way to change this is to fundamentally change the details, for example, that a company needs from you to process a loan or the information that they keep on record about you. It could even be a case of, you know, your company keeps a lot of your details on file because they're making tax payments on your behalf, you know, they're paying your SOXO contributions or whatever. All of these things are databases. They all have your personal details in them and none of them are secure. We have to give these companies information and they do their best, for the most part, to keep your information safe. Sometimes we find out the companies don't have very strong data protection, but at the same time, we know that hackers can get into even the most secure databases. So as I said at the beginning, I think the safest assumption you can make is that people already have your information.
That was Culture Pop's Matt Armitage speaking about the alleged data breach that was first reported in Laogat, and then Laogat was told to take it off on the orders of the Malaysian Communications and Multimedia Commission. Well, there's several issues here. Why is it that MCMC wanted them to take it down? Was it because the report was not true, or was it that it was just very alarming? And was this a question of kind of damage control or information control? I think that's one issue. The other issue is that if this was true, then, you know, are we going to hear more about this, and what kind of, you know, things are going to need to be put in place? I know, Chuang, you would have us run for the hills at this point in time.
Yeah, because what Matt says actually is very true. Whatever is on the internet data-wise is not sacrosanct. It is not 100% secure. Not even the text messages that you sent on WhatsApp, because of course infiltration occurs. I just want to say one of the next big things in the software industry, in the technology industry, and this, you know, there's many, many big things always happening and always popping up, but one of the emerging trends is crimeware as a service. It's known as CAS, right? And basically, you can go to, and anybody can go to the dark web, look for somebody to hack another system for you and pay next to nothing for you. I just got this example here, right? You, to hack a web server, it only costs $267. And they even accept payments in bitcoins, because at this point in time, this menu is only going to cost you 0.43 bitcoins, right? You can hack a personal computer for $143. You can implement a 24-hour DDoS attack on a company for $461, or basically 0.743 bitcoins. So basically, you can hire hackers anywhere around the world to hack somebody or some things or some corporation's system for this much money.
But, you know, of course, there are people who are, and companies that invest in protecting themselves, and they create firewalls and I don't know what other technological, you know, wizardry in order to protect the data. So on one hand, you have people, the mercenaries that you mentioned, and then on the other hand, there are people who work to protect you.
And whether that's enough. Judging from what Matt said, it's true. He said we've got to the point where now we just have to assume that our data has been stolen at any point in time, right? And for all you know, maybe it's just not hacking. Maybe it's people within the company that are selling this information.
Yeah. I mean, my biggest fear is that somebody's siphoning off my money, right? Because I do a lot of online transactions. I do my banking online. I never used to. Then I became very comfortable with it. And then I thought, well, I would notice.
These are all just digits, basically,
yeah,
right?
I would know if somebody was taking money from me. Because, I mean, first of all, I don't have that much. So when you know, the large amounts move.
Don't be so humble, Asha. Come on.
No, when
subjective. You wouldn't see.
Okay.
Relative to Robert Kwok.
Calm down. Okay. But yeah, I would notice. If money went. But what if the system, you know, because I'm just one person, the system might not care to rob me. They just want to rob a mass of people, right? So if you're going to hack 2 million people and all you need is taking, you know, 20 cents out of these 2 million, you know, on a regular basis, I would never notice a 20 cent leaving, you know, my coffers, would you? I mean, you wouldn't. And so that might be the nature of the crime. It might not be a kind of a, you know, like somebody come and rob you in your house and take, you know, away your television. It happened to me before. I walked in my house.
Yeah.
I looked to my left, assuming my television was there, didn't see it, walked on. And I thought, oh, something's missing. I walked back and I saw the television's gone. Crime's not going to be like that anymore, right? Because we're really trading at the level of millions and billions of people that could be hacked simultaneously. I mean, if one is to believe the report.
It's just not money. I'm also particular about like data. Like they know stuff about you. They have things about like your IC number. If the story is true, your IC number, perhaps your date of birth, like important data that they can use for,
Well, they send me a birthday card, all the better than my birthday.
So if you're a share market investor, if you're an investor, period, okay, your stuff is going to be, your information is going to be held in data, basically digital data, right? That is why there's a huge swath of populations that are buying physical stuff. That's why there's a huge argument for holding physical gold. People are holding pieces of silver. People are buying land. They're buying agricultural land.
Nice watches?
Nice watches, yes.
Now, join this conversation. Tell us if you are afraid of, news of data breaches. Does it make you sit up? Does it make you think about changing your habits, getting off a line in terms of doing your banking and such? You can tweet us at BFM Radio, or you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. That's 018-789-8899. Joyce, would you change your habits? I mean, knowing that this happened and recognizing that what Matt was saying was real, does it actually force you to change your habits? Or are you just going to go on with your fingers crossed?
I'm like you. I used to not do e-banking because I was a bit particular and all that. But somehow, after that, the convenience of it, I end up being sucked into it. But there are some things that I do not, like for Chuang, I'm a bit wary of tech. So my credit card, the bank has this whole voice recognition thing where they can use, you can allow and say, use my voice, and it will give them authority to, you just use your voice. You don't need to do the steps and give password, all that. But I'm not opting for that. So it depends.
You find that the numbers are more reliable. Getting your tag number.
And then asking you about the passwords, your password codes or some like your mom's name and things like that. I feel that is better for me than just taking my voice.
Because my mother's maiden name is also on a database.
I've got an apocalyptic view of this whole issue. People think they're mitigating the circumstances by, the privacy settings on social media or not opting for voice recognition software on your docket for the banks. But you know what? At the end of the day, the movement towards digital is basically inexorable. Okay? Even the Central Bank of Malaysia is outlawing checkbooks, right? So, I mean, the future is there, right? What you do to mitigate it? Either you run for the hills, as I've always advocated, or you embrace it full on.
Resistance is not possible. Futile. Resistance is futile, it is. Okay, we'll be back with more. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.